Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 112, Catching Fire by Suzanne Collins.
You understand that whatever I do, it comes back to you and Mom. I don't want you to get hurt.
Since the last games, something's different. I can see it.
What can you see?
Hope.
You saved us.
I know that.
But I can't go on acting for the cameras and then just ignoring each other in real life.
She's not who they think she is. She has to be eliminated.
I agree, but in the right way, at the right time.
We have to go before they kill us. They will kill us.
People want to fight.
I'm staying here.
He fought very hard in the games, Miss Everdeen. But they were games. Would you like to be in a real war? Imagine thousands of your people dead. Your loved ones gone.
What do I need to do?
This is the 75th year of the Hunger Games. The tributes are to be reaped from the existing pool of victors.
I get to say goodbye.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that's brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether or not it is required reading. I'm Tom Panarese, one of your hosts, and I'm diving back into the arena in Panem with my fellow District 12 tributes, who is definitely going to outlive me once again as we go one more time through the Hunger Games. Surviving this with me is Stella. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. A minor bit of joy is that I just promoted the Valentine's Day episode of Backworld Oracle, and I was tagging Tom, and I decided to tag Robin's crotch for Tom, and so I giggled while I was doing that. If you're on Instagram and you touch it, you can see that Tom is the little green.
Great.
Anywho, but yes,
because there's no butt shot on the cover of that.
Yeah,
Nightwing.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Well, not everyone can be that. That's a very like high real estate, you know, place.
It's the highest praise you can give a man is that his butt's like Dick Grayson's.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I feel like I probably would protect you in a Katniss Peeta sort of way, where you might find yourself into some troubles and I come and help you out. So I could see that happening.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that.
Of course.
So Yeah, we've done this. We've done these out of order, in a sense, kind of. Well, because this is interesting. So we did the Hunger Games like way, way back, right? And we've always been meaning to get around to Catching Fire, which obviously was the second book of the Hunger Games trilogy, and Mockingjay, which is the one that we haven't done yet. But then The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes came out, and we did that right as it came out, I believe. And then same thing with Sunrise on the Reaping, which came out last year.
Yeah.
And now we're back to the original trilogy. We'll eventually get down to Mockingjay, of course. So actually and we will kind of talk a little bit about Sunrise on the Reaping, because it does directly tie into Catching Fire for reasons we'll see in the synopsis and everything. But yeah, so this is interesting. I've just kind of been looking forward to getting back to this and going on some more. That we always talk a little bit about our history with the books. I can't remember if you were reading the Hunger Games as they came out, or if they had been out already, like all the books had been out already before you finally picked up the first one. So like, how does your history with at least Catching Fire go?
2009. Yeah. So it's definitely after. Probably my second year at my previous school. So that would have been 2011, 2012 school year. So that's when I was, giving it a go. And I think I basically read all three, like once I gave that for the Hunger Games, once I read that and I was gripped, then I just read the other ones. And I think by that point too, because, you know, the film was kind of starting up a bit, that's when I feel like the novels became more popular. I'm sure they were popular in 2009, but I wasn't really hearing about them, but I was also finishing up my university career. So so this would have been around that time that I was reading it, and have read it several times.
Oh,
so yes, and of course, you know, the movies too. Mm-hmm. This is, many say that this is the best one, which will be interesting to have that discussion.
Yeah,
of the original trilogy.
I read them all in a row, and I want to say it was 6 months to a year after Mockingjay came out, so I don't know exactly what year that was, but Amanda had gotten them on loan from like a friend or something, and then was like, these are really good. So we were both read through them pretty quickly, one after the other. That's the only time I've read it. So this is my second time reading it this time around, and it's been at least a decade, maybe 15 years. So it's kind of interesting to come back to this after, even though I remember a lot of the story beats and some things. And of course I have seen the movie as well. So this would be interesting. So let's do a little bit. Now, I'm not going to get into the history of the author herself. I'm just going to go behind the history of the book, because we did talk about Suzanne Collins herself in the Hunger Games episode. We've done like three episodes on these books at this point. So Catching Fire was obviously the second book. The Hunger Games is a very successful young adult book, and it was really supposed to be released on September 8th of 2009, but it's actually moved up a week in response to requests by retailers to move the release to before Labor Day and the start of the school year. It was published as an audiobook on the same day. Advanced reading copies were available at Book Expo America in New York City and were sent out to some booksellers. They were also offered as prizes in a scholastic contest called How Would You Survive? It was a writing contest. The ebook was published in June of 2010. Which is kind of funny. This is how long ago this was, where the idea of having the ebook available on the same day as the physical copy was still not like completely done, I guess. Because usually you hear like a book comes out and it's available like in all formats at once. So it's kind of interesting that like it took another like 6 months, 9 months to get the ebook out. So I just find that interesting. As of March 2012, the book had sold over 10 million copies. I'm sure there's more than that these days. I have a little bit of an interview that Collins did with NPR back in 2009, right around the time this came out. And here's an excerpt from it. The heroine of this trilogy, 16-year-old Katniss Everdeen, won the Hunger Games, but also defied the all-powerful government with symbolic gestures and actions during the competition. In doing so, she has inspired the stirrings of rebellion across the country. Only gradually does Katniss begin to understand that she has become a symbol for the spreading rebellion. Quote, "This is someone who has rebel status thrust upon her," Collins says of Katniss. "And she's not always comfortable with it, did not plan it, but eventually is able to carry it." Children's literature expert Anita Sylvie agrees. She says that the violence in Collins' books, and this one is especially violent in a number of places, not that the other ones were light, but, you know. She says the violence in Collins' books is a reflection of what's happening in the culture. Reality TV has gone lower and lower every season. We are sending our young people to the other side of the world to kill young people, and children and teens are killing each other in schools. When you have all those elements to throw in the cauldron of the story, I don't think it's surprising that The Hunger Games comes out of that. And for her part, Collins believes her target audience, which is kids entering adolescence, is just the right age to take on the challenge that underlines the story. She says they're themselves beginning to question authority, and they are themselves beginning to look at government and situations throughout the world and wonder if they are moral or not, says Collins. Thankfully, we got over that, right? Everything's moral in government these days. Anyway, you have to have that. You have to have at some point in your life question the environment, the political situation around you, and decide whether it's right or not. And if it isn't, what part you are going to play in that. So Catching Fire itself received many positive reviews. Publishers Weekly wrote that if the second installment spends too much time recapping the events from book one, it doesn't disappoint when it segues into the pulse-pounding action readers come to expect. The book list commented how the unadorned prose provides an open window, perfect pacing, and electrifying world-building. New York Times gave it a positive review. It says, Collins has done that rare thing. She's written a sequel that improves upon the first book. As a reader, I felt excited and even hopeful. Could it be that this series and its characters were actually going somewhere? And praised how Katniss became more sophisticated in the book. They did receive some negative reviews in the review from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Says that after 150 pages of romantic dithering, I was tapping my foot to move on. Entertainment Weekly called the book weaker than the first and wrote, Katniss pretends to be in love with her sweet-natured games teammate, Peter Malark, but she secretly pines for the brooding Gale, a childhood friend, except why? There's little distinction between the two thinly imagined guys, other than the fact that PETA has a dopier name. Collins conjures none of the erotic energy that makes Twilight, so for instance, so creepily alluring. I don't want to hear the words erotic energy in reference to anybody who's 16. Editorializing aside, Time magazine named Catching Fire the fourth top fiction book of 2009. People magazine rated it in their eighth best book of 2009. It won Publisher Weekly's best book of the year for 2009. And of course, there was a movie because The Hunger Games starring Jennifer Lawrence as Katniss was very successful. So Catching Fire was put into production. It was released in 2013. In addition to the returning cast members from the first film, the new film cast included Jenna Malone as Joanna Mason, Philip Seymour Hoffman as Plutarch Havensby, Lynn Cohen as Mags, Alan Richson as Gloss, Sam Claflin as Finnick, and Jeffrey Wright as Beatty. The film was successful, grossing more than $800 million to become the fifth highest grossing film at the box office in 2013 and receiving positive reviews from critics. In fact, if I remember correctly, this was like one of the, I think out of the original four movies, if you recall correctly, they divided Mockingjay into two films. This was like the most praised one. I think this is considered the best of the trilogy of the Hunger Games films as well. All right. So anything before we go on to the plot synopsis?
Negative.
Okay. I got my synopsis from the Hunger Games wiki, which, and the synopsis I will tell you is incredibly long and detailed and needed an edit. And I did my best to edit it down. But I wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything important. Because sometimes we've looked at synopses for these books and whoever wrote them like left out like major plot points. Katniss Everdeen and Peter Malark both survived the Hunger Games. They both return home wanting and expecting a somewhat peaceful future, but the capital is angry and the Capitol wants revenge. When rumors of a rebellion that she started reach Katniss's ears, everything changes. And now, as PETA and Katniss are forced to visit the districts in the mandatory victory tour, everything can and will go wrong. If they cannot pull off their act as two madly in love teenagers, if they fail, both their families and their entire district could be in danger of President Snow's wrath. Part one of the book is called The Spark. So Katniss is now back in District 12, and she's living in the Victor's Village, which is just a very nice neighborhood that has set aside for the victors of the Hunger Games. And I'm assuming these are in every district. However, she has only two neighbors. One of them is PETA, and the other one is the only other person from District 12 to win, according to, you know, official records, and who is still alive, which is Haymitch Abernathy. They're soon going to have to leave home for the victory tour. This is where they go to like each district and make public appearances. Katniss expected that when she returned, everything would be fine and the same, but Gale seems further away from now than ever, and he's working in the mines. The victory tour comes up, and Katniss has more on her mind than ever. During the day, she's bored with her new life because she has everything and really nothing better to do with her time. She has money, a good home, and a constant supply of food. So she goes hunting game like she used to, and one day when she returns, an unexpected visitor appears. It's President Snow. He explains to Katniss that during the last Hunger Games, when she tried to commit suicide with PETA by eating poisonous nightlock berries, she ignited a possible uprising in the districts. President Snow and Katniss have a lengthy conversation about the fact that if she doesn't convince the districts that she made the decision of temporary lovesickness, then he would personally make sure she suffers. Katniss, who is now convinced she started a fire she cannot control, tries her best to convince everyone that she and PETA are madly in love. When they go to District 11, which is their first destination, so I believe the tour is counting down toward the capital, so to speak, she gets to meet the families of Thresh and Rue, who were the two tributes killed by the Kreers in the previous novel. When it is time for a public speech to begin, she thanks the people of District 11 for their contributions to her during the Hunger Games and is about to leave when one of Rue's siblings gives her such a look that Katniss quickly comes back to make one final speech. She tells everyone the story about how Thresh spared her life and how Rue became a valued ally during the games. After her speech, an old man whistles her and Rue's four-note tune that meant they were safe, and the crowd simultaneously does a traditional District 12 gesture to show their thanks. Right after Katniss finishes her speech, she realizes she forgot something, so she goes back to retrieve it. That's when she sees a peacekeeper shoot the man who whistled in the head. Afterward, Katniss and PETA confess what had happened to Haymitch. He tells Katniss to explain to PETA what is going on. So Katniss tells PETA everything about President Snow, the threat of the uprisings, and how they're all in jeopardy if something doesn't change soon. PETA becomes angry and tells Katniss and Haymitch to stop keeping secrets from them, and then he leaves. The rest of the victory tour is routine, and Katniss and the crew get to the Capitol. That night, when she and PETA go to get interviewed by Caesar, PETA performs a fake proposal, which she accepts. Caesar's beside himself, the audience is hysterical, and the crowds in the districts are overflowing with happiness. President Snow then makes an unexpected appearance to congratulate the newly engaged couple. Katniss then makes a discreet gesture to President Snow to ask him if she was convincing enough, to which he replies no, with an almost imperceptible shake of the head. On their way back to District 12, Katniss suffers from terrifying nightmares throughout the ride on the train, so PETA sleeps in her bed to calm her and keep her company. Finally, they get back to District 12 and a huge party is thrown. While in the mayor's home, Katniss sees the mayor's television and she sees that there's an uprising in District 8. She arranges a secret meeting with Gale, at which Gale confesses his love for her, but she says that she does not have those feelings for him. Gale gets angry and disappointed, but before he leaves, Katniss accidentally tells him there was a rebellion in District 8. Gale says that they could have a rebellion in 12 as well, and he runs off to spread the news. Katniss then goes to PETA to ask him if he would run away with her, and he says yes, but while they are discussing the plans, they see that Gale is being violently whipped in the square by an unfamiliar man. Katniss steps in to stop the man, whose name is Romulus Thread, but he gives her a lash across the face. She gets severely hurt, but Haymitch and PETA step in to save her. Eventually, the people of District 12, including many who frequent the Hob, convince Thread to stop whipping Gale. As soon as he leaves, everyone helps Katniss take Gale to her mother. Katniss's mother tries to soothe the pain by giving him medicine, when suddenly Madge, the mayor's daughter, comes with some morphling to help soothe Gale's pain. Later on that night, Katniss says she picks Gale, but is torn between Peeta and Gale. The next day, there is a huge blizzard, during which Thread constructs several stockades, an official whipping post, and a gallows, as well as a series of machine gun positions perched on the rooftops in the square. While walking in town, Haymitch, Katniss, and Peeta see these ugly tools of torture, and the hob is destroyed by the peacekeepers. The last thing Katniss notices when leaving the square is that she does not recognize even one of the peacekeepers' faces. Katniss realizes she cannot stand to be at home, so she goes into the woods and heads to the lake. She sees two peacekeepers, and before she shoots them, one of them holds up a cracker with a mockingjay on it. Part 2 is called The Quell. These two peacekeepers are actually two young women from District 8, Bonnie and Twill. They tell Katniss about the uprising in the district. They were headed to District 13, according to them, because they think the people live there and they live underground, because the Capitol reuses old footage of District 13 whenever it's shown on TV, as they believe they will always see the same bird in the same place. And this leads Katniss to wonder what the district currently looks like, because supposedly it was destroyed in the Civil War that eventually brought about the Hunger Games. She gives the women her food supplies and shows them how to hunt. When the evening comes, they leave her and she returns to the village. However, she realizes that the fence around the district is now electrified and she is unable to enter the village through her normal passage. She decides she needs to go over the fence and searches for the right tree. She climbs up and over and must jump 25 feet in the air, and she lands and hurts her tailbone and her heel. On a mandatory television broadcast that night, President Snow appears with a wooden box. He reminds the audience of the dark days and when the Hunger Games were born. He states that every 25 years, the anniversary of the Hunger Games is marked by a quarter quell, a glorified version of the games. He talks about the first quell when every district was made to vote on who was sent to the Hunger Games. In the second quell, every district was forced to send twice as many tributes into the Hunger Games. The wooden box holds the information for the third quarter quell. Snow pulls out an envelope and states that the male and female tributes will be reaped from the existing pool of victors. Since District 12 has only three winners, who are Peeta, Haymitch, and Katniss, Katniss knows that she is going to be forced to go back to the Hunger Games. She runs out of the house into the basement of an empty house to scream and cry. She makes her way to Haymitch, where he already tells her Peeta has come to visit him and told him that Peeta wants to go back into the arena to protect her. She tells Haymitch that whatever they do, she wants Haymitch to make sure Peeta comes back alive. She and Haymitch get drunk, and the next afternoon she goes back to Haymitch's house, where Peeta has emptied all of his liquor and has threatened to turn them or anyone who gives them alcohol in. He tells them they will be training for the quarter quell because two people will come back alive, and they begin to work out and study footage of past winners to see their competition. On the day of the reaping, Katniss has decided to say goodbye to Gale to tell him how much he means to her. The reaping has Katniss as only choice for female. The male competitor is chosen as Haymitch, but Peeta volunteers to take his place. But they don't get to tell their families and friends goodbye because they're brought directly to the train and they leave for the capital. Once at the capital, they eat and find out who the competitors from the other district are. And that night, after Katniss is woken from a nightmare, she goes to see Peeta. They decide to watch more videos and come across Haymitch's victory from the second quarter quell, which they have never seen. Katniss recognizes the name Maisley Donner as her mother's friend and realizes that she was a twin to Katniss's friend Madge's mother. She also sees her mother crying and embracing Maisley when she is called. Katniss also sees Haymitch being called up. She notes that he was powerful looking and even somewhat handsome. Haymitch allied with Maisley, and after Maisley was killed by the birds, he became one of the last two remaining tributes, the other being a female career tribute from District 1. As we saw in Sunrise on the Reaping, he used the force field during the final fight with his adversary because she threw the axe at him. It was repelled back and by the force field and killed her. So he was crowned victor of the 50th Hunger Games. President Snow, however, was furious that Haymitch used the trick, which Katniss would later describe as being almost as bad as the berries. Katniss wonders what the Capitol did to punish Haymitch. Once they arrive, they're ushered to prepare for the opening ceremonies. Haymitch tells them that they must form alliances this year and make friends. During training, Katniss befriends Wyrus and Beatty from District 3. They point out the force field used to separate the game makers from the tributes. Katniss displays her archery skills and is wanted by many to be in an alliance. In her solo performance for the game makers, both PETA and Katniss are unsure of what to do. PETA goes first, and after a long wait, Katniss goes. She doesn't know what PETA did, but she can tell the game makers are angry. She sees Plutarch Havensby, the new head game maker, and she has an idea. She ties a noose to a dummy with berry juice, writes the name Seneca Crane, the former head game maker during Katniss's Hunger Games, who let both Katniss and PETA live, and he was executed on the orders of President Snow. Afterwards, she finds out that PETA made a drawing of Rue with the flowers on the ground, which could not be washed away and was covered by the game makers. Haymitch is not happy because now they have made enemies. Their training scores are shown. Katniss wonders to Cinna if anyone has ever received a 0, but instead she and PETA both received 12, which means that they are targets. PETA and Katniss stay together that night, and Katniss has come to accept her death, which she knows will be the spark for the rebellion. That night, both do not have nightmares. The following day, they spend their entire day and night alone together on the roof. The day of the interview, Cinna comes in with her wardrobe specifically chosen for her by President Snow. It's the chosen wedding gown from her photo shoot earlier, and I believe the citizens, she displayed several wedding gowns, and the citizens were asked to vote for their favorite, and this is the one that won. She notes to Cinna that it's heavier than before, but he explains that he had to do some alterations, and he says, "Don't lift your arms until you twirl on television." The interview atmosphere is different from the previous year. The tributes are speaking out against the Capitol, asking why President Snow is not stopping this if he is great and powerful. The second to last tribute to speak is Katniss, who comes on stage with the dress on, apologizing to the crowd for not letting them see her get married. She twirls and raises her arms, and the wedding dress burns away to reveal a different dress underneath. When she looks toward the television, she realizes that Cinna has turned her into a mockingjay. Although Caesar knows what the dress represents, they play it off as the bird on Katniss's token. Next comes PETA, the last tribute to speak, and he tells the audience that he and Katniss are already married, and Katniss is pregnant. This drives the audience to madness and hysteria. As PETA makes his way back to the other tributes, he holds Katniss's hands amongst the chaos. In turn, she grabs the hand or the stump of Chaff, who is next to her. And then all the tributes join in. They hold hands before the Capitol has time to turn the cameras off. Katniss knows that by doing this, the joining of unity on the stage, it's rippled into the districts and will stir the rebellion even more. They say their goodbyes to Haymitch. He tells them to stay alive and to always remember who the real enemy is. Getting ready for the ceremony, she's in a room with Cinna when she steps on the plate to be taken to the arena. She's frozen in place. She can't move. And that's when Cinna is arrested by 3 peacekeepers and beaten into submission and dragged out of the room. Katniss is frozen. She watches in horror. Then she's transported to the arena and left in the middle of blue water, which she realizes is, quote, no place for a girl on fire. Part 3 is the enemy. When the gong sounds, Katniss dives into the water, swims to shore, noticing she feels very light and fast. First to arrive, she heads for the weapons. As the crews would do, she grabs bows and arrows. She hears the noise. She turns to kill the person behind her. It's Finnick O'Dare from District 4, I believe. And he has his trident rage. So she sees his gold bracelet that once belonged to Haymitch and realizes that this was the way of telling her to form an alliance. Then he saves her life from a guy from District 5. They search the other items. The cornucopia only contains weapons. They and the couriers are now making their way to shore. So Katniss tries to shoot one of them, but misses and shoots Gloss, another tribute, in the calf. She aims for Brutus, who is charging toward her, but manages to stop it with his belt before it punctures his liver. She realizes that PETA is on the metal plate and goes to retrieve him, but Finnick offers to do it. And Katniss knows Mags, one of the older tributes, jump into the water and doggy paddle to shore. When PETA and Finnick are on the shore, Mags explains to Finnick, who's the only person who apparently understands her, because I believe they're from the same district, that the belts are flotation devices. They run into the jungle, Finnick will carry Mags. Peeta leads the way. As they are walking, they search for drinkable water. Katniss notices a shimmering square and realizes that it's the force field that surrounds the arena. Before she can stop him, Peeta walks into the force field and is repelled back, knocking Mags and Finnick to the ground. Peeta is not breathing. Panicked, Katniss begins to slap him, but his heart is stopped. Finnick performs CPR. Katniss has no idea what's going on. She starts fighting him, but he slaps her away, and Peeta is eventually resuscitated. Peeta asks Katniss how she recognizes force fields. She lies and says that she can hear it because the hearing aid she got put in her left ear after being deafened is picking these things up. She doesn't want to give this away. So they have to move on. Katniss climbs a tree. She sees that the arena is actually a perfect circle. She says there's a wheel in the center and that she'd not see any water, but perhaps there'll be streams within the jungle. Katniss later hunts. She shoots what she thinks is a tree rat. She knows that its nose is wet, which means there's water nearby, but she can't figure out where it is. She brings the food back to the camp where Peeta has the idea to throw the food into the force field to cook it, which does actually work. A silver parachute floats down. Peeta opens it to reveal a spile, which is the thing that you plug into a tree to get the sap out, like when they're making maple syrup. They plug it in, and instead of sap in the trees, it's water. So this is their water source. After the first night, there are 12 people dead and sees lightning in the distance. After an hour, the lightning stops. The rain begins. She hears cannons eating and indicating another death and notices fog in the distance. She realizes it's an unnatural fog created by the games makers, and the mist from the fog causes blisters where it touches. When Peeta stumbles as they're running away from it, she notices it and also that it also attacks the nerves because his face droops and his legs stop working. Finnick agrees to carry Peeta if Katniss can carry Mags, which she agrees to. But after a while, Katniss cannot carry Mags anymore as her legs have become paralyzed. Finnick comes back and tells Katniss he cannot carry them both. Mags kisses Finnick and runs into the fog, convulsing and dying. Three continue on. After not being able to move any further due to exhaustion, Katniss turns to the fog to watch it and realizes that it stops as if it's meeting an invisible wall. It disappears, and Katniss finds the body of salt water from the beginning of the games. It burns at first when she goes in, but she realizes the water forces the poison from the fog out of her body. So she basically, they do that to get their strength. And then they're attacked by a bunch of monkeys. No, I'm not kidding. These are mutations. They fight them off. One of them lunges to bite Peeta's chest while he's distracted, but the female morphling from District 6, and morphlings are people who are I guess the best you could say they're like opioid or meth addicts, because morphling is kind of like a morphine type of medication, and they're addicted to these things. So there's one from District 6 who is like that, and she comes out of nowhere to put herself between Peeta and the mutt, and she's bitten instead. The monkeys retreat, and they stay with her until she dies. Later, Katniss gets medicine for the poison. They eventually see a tsunami charge through and hit part of the arena, but the water does reach their camp. They eventually meet up with an ally themselves with Joanna Mason, BT, and Wireless, because Finnick clearly has some sort of alliance with Joanna. BT has received a knife in the back, and Wireless is spinning in a circle. All three of them are covered in red. Joanna explains that when the lightning finished and it began to rain, they thought it was water, but it was blood. Meanwhile, Wireless starts to spin in circles again and says, "Tick-tock, tick-tock." Joanna gets annoyed at her, then pushes her to the ground, and Katniss tells her to give Wireless a break. Joanna replies by pushing Katniss down as well. Later on, while they're keeping watch, Joanna and Katniss talk about Mags and how she died. Katniss asks what she was doing with Wireless and Beatty, and Joanna states that Haymitch told her to bring them to Katniss for an alliance. Later that night, Katniss sees the lightning again. When Wireless restates tick-tock, Katniss begins to realize the arena is in the shape of a clock, and Wireless is relieved because someone finally understands her. Katniss quickly explains the situation to the team and remembers Plutarch Havensby showing her his clock watch and saying it begins at midnight as an image of a mockingjay flashed on the watch face. So they go to the cornucopia to see if they're correct. They're proven to be right. BD starts to feel a little better, tells the work group that Wireless is not only very smart but intuitive. So they start drawing a map of the clock, and Katniss realizes that Wireless has actually stopped singing and turns with an arrow, and one of the other tributes, Gloss, is there. She hits him in the temple while Joanna buries an axe in one of the others, who is named Kashmir. As they try to follow the tributes from District 2, the cornucopia starts to spin really fast. Beatty is thrown from the island, and Katniss goes to Wyrus's body to retrieve a wire that Beatty wanted desperately. When they go back to the jungle, they conclude that the jungle sections could have been switched, so they're not going to know what's going on until the tidal wave. So Katniss starts to realize that everybody's protecting Peeta. She wonders if they believe that he can be like a rebellion leader or something. And at this point, she hears Prim screaming. It's a Jabberjay, and Finnick runs to help, but he hears the screaming of Annie Cresta, who was his partner in District 4 all those years ago. And basically, it's like kind of a psychological torture. They become trapped in this wedge of the clock with the Jabberjays just screaming and screaming at them. She's obviously upset, and Peeta calms her down by telling her that Prim and the others were not tortured, because as the final eight, their families will be interviewed, and they cannot do that if the families are dead. Finnick asks Beatty if this is true, and he agrees. So later they come up with a plan to figure with this wire that they retrieved. And the plan is to go to the lightning tree and tire the wire around the lightning tree and run the wire into the ocean, making the beach a conductor to electrocute everything in its path, thanks to the dampness of the tidal wave at 10 o'clock. Katniss and Joanna are charged with running the wire down to the beach because they are the fastest. However, when the wire is cut by Brutus and Anobaria to the other tributes, Joanna knocks Katniss over the head with the heavy coil and cuts into Katniss's arm. Joanna tells her to stay down and runs off. Brutus later storms in, telling Anobaria to leave Katniss because she's, quote, as good as dead. Katniss hears Finnick running up, but stays quiet so as not to alert him to her whereabouts, since she believes that he and Joanna have actually betrayed her. She struggles to make her way to the lightning tree and sees Beatty on the ground with a knife and more wire. She realizes that he was trying to cut through the force field that lies close to the tree, and then sees that just beyond the force field is the real world. At that moment, she hears Peeta calling her name, and because she is so wounded, she does the only thing she can, which is to call to him, alerting her enemies so Peeta can have a shot at winning. She collapses after hearing cannons sound off and replays Haymitch's last words in her mind, "Remember who the real enemy is," and realizes he was referring to the Capitol. She knows that Beatty was trying to blow up the force field, so what she does is she wraps the wire around an arrow and shoots it straight into the flaw in the force field at the exact moment when the lightning strikes the tree, and this blows up the arena. She lays there just realizing that the Capitol will not let anyone live after this, and she's just killed Peeta because of it. She sees Plutarch Heavensbeak come over to her and closes her eyes, and she passes out. She awakens in a hospital bed next to Beatty. She searches for Peeta, believing that the Capitol has captured her and is planning to kill Peeta to save him from being tortured. She passes a room and hears Plutarch talking to Finnick and Haymitch about getting someone out of District 4. She opens the door and Haymitch tells her there was a plan to break them out the minute the quell was announced. The victors from Districts 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, and 11 had varying degrees of knowledge about it. Plutarch had been for several years part of a group planning to overthrow the Capitol. He made sure the wire was among the weapons, as it was to be used to blow up the force field. The bread drops they were getting were code for a rescue, and the hovercraft that they're piloting is from District 13, and that's where they're headed. Upset, she asks why she and Peeta were not informed. Haymitch says that once the force field exploded, she and Peeta would be the prime targets, and the less they knew, the better in case of capture. She tells them Joanna tried to kill her, but Finnick explains that what she did when she stabbed her in the arm was actually remove Katniss's tracker, and that all the victor tributes in those districts have pledged their lives to her and the rebellion. She is the Mockingjay, the symbol of that rebellion. Haymitch tells her that everyone kept Peeta alive because they knew that if he died, she would never keep an alliance with the others. She asks where Peeta is, and Haymitch tells her that he was picked up along with Joanna and Anobaria and by the Capitol. In horror and anger, she attacks Haymitch, scratching his face. Finnick and others strap her down and drug her to keep her calm. Finnick tells her that the Capitol will at least keep Peeta alive to use as bait against her. Later, Gale visits her. He says that after the games, the Capitol sent bombers to the districts. He explains that he was able to get her family out in time, but District 12 has been destroyed. And that is the cliffhanger ending of Catching Fire. Stella, upon yet another reading of it, does it hold up? Do you like it?
Yes, it does hold up, and yes, I like it. And in these fun times we're living in, it's it's even more relevant.
Yeah. I liked it too. I had forgotten, though, I will say that I've forgotten how long this does take to get to the reaping and the games. Because when we talked about the Hunger Games a few years ago, I remember saying I had forgotten how quickly we get to the moment where she volunteers a tribute. I was under the impression there was like much more, but it actually happens pretty early in the book. This is the opposite, where there's a lot going on and we eventually get to it. Did you have any problems with the pacing? I know that was one of the criticisms in one of the reviews that it does dither on for a little
Yeah, it's interesting because with Sunrise Reaping, sorry, I had to think about which one it
while.
was. Apologies. That one, I felt the pacing a bit more. I felt like we were really taking a while to set things up and get to the reaping. This one, it might seem that way, but I feel like we're not going to just jump into the reaping right away. You have to see what is like, this is like an epilogue to Hunger Games, right? Initially, because they won. What's life like for them? How is she dealing with the fake or not fake, the love triangle, all of that stuff. So I feel like it's an appropriate amount of time, honestly. And if you are invested in Katniss, then you should be invested in this quote unquote downtime. I think it also paves the way for how dangerous Snow is. If you didn't think he was dangerous before, now you know what it's actually like. And I disagree also with the review, only that I think maybe the people are against the review because there would be no way that there would be a Team Gale cadre of people. Like, people literally are Team Gale if not for this, right? So they would have had to have bought in somehow.
Yeah, the love triangle aspect of it, on the one hand, she's a 16, 17-year-old girl, so the teenage love triangle boys and all that sort of stuff, and I know I'm being stereotypical here, but the idea that teenagers swoon and fall in love, and that's one of the things that they do keep, they do think about a lot. But at the same time, I feel like I kind of blame the Twilight series for the whole Gale Peeta thing, like that.
Oh.
Maybe that Collins meant to put the love triangle in there, but the idea that that was, I think it's made to be more important to the novel than it actually is. Because this came out around the same time the Twilight novels were coming out, and that was, Team Edward and Team Jacob, and it was like a huge thing. And I was wondering if this is like, the Twilightification of young adult literature back then, where there were always the triangles and love stories and things like that amidst all the dystopia and the action and stuff like that. And I wonder if that's kind of like this is kind of like a byproduct of it. Although I think it does work for her character development, though, because she's being pulled in so many different directions, right? So that's one of them. And she has to contend with the feelings she's obviously developing for Peeta. Any other thoughts about the love triangle before we actually get to Katniss herself?
Well, I think it's an interesting dive into psychology and human behavior because, on the one hand, you have Gale, with whom she's grown up, boy next door. They've seen everything and experienced everything together in terms of living near each other and hunting and all of that stuff. And Peeta has been on the outskirts, I would say, of her life, with the exception of, giving her some burnt bread initially. But that was a lot of trauma bonding, being in the arena together. And so you kind of wonder what is and what isn't real. And I think I know people become frustrated with Katniss and her ability to, or her inability really to ch choose someone or understand what her feelings are. But going back to your point about how old these people are, as well as that is a tough decision. If are the feelings that she's feeling for Peeta because she actually does love him, or because they were surviving this terrible experience together? And then is Gale, does she love him, or is it because he's a safe space? So I feel like there are some depths to explore there, though I don't necessarily disagree with your thought about love triangles being kind of the thing to have for YA novels around the time.
Yeah, it does give her. I mean, if it had been really focused on over and over and over again, it was like almost overshadowed the true conflict of the novel, which is the Capitol and President Snow and her, because like her and President Snow by the end of this novel, and especially into Mockingjay, are like very good adversaries for one another. There's like a real like Collins, I think, with that first scene where he shows up in the house, like builds this tension between the two of them, which is not resolved until the end of the last novel. And I think it's really good. So that adds something to this where it doesn't let the love triangle, love story aspect of it completely get in the way. I mean, of course, you're right. She's going to be thinking about Gale for a lot of the time because of the fact that they're so close. Even if they weren't in love and they were actually cousins, which is the cover story given. And she was just very close to him. That would have been a predominant thought in her head as she had to go through this whole process again. But I think the one review is right, is that like Katniss gets a lot of more depth in this novel to me than in the first one. She was already a reluctant hero because she was, but her cause was really, really noble. She stepped up to save her sister. Here, she's thrown back in the arena. And she sees herself becoming this symbol or celebrity for an uprising, which is not something she asked to do or she asked for. So she's really reluctant to acknowledge that, even though by the end she does understand her importance. Do you think that she accepts that? What do you think this does for her as a character development?
That she's a hero?
Yeah, does she accept like being the hero that they say she is, or is she still kind of like on the fence, or she's still reluctant about
Yeah, I don't think she ever leans into that. I think even at the very end when she shoots the new president, that she I don't think she ever considers herself that hero. I think it's just this uncomfortable dress that is put on her. I think she leans into it as much as she has to because she recognizes that she is, because it's all about being a symbol here. And even I think the squad that's looking to save her, they also see her more as a symbol rather than a leader. It's just what she can do for them in that way rather than her actual capability. So I think she recognizes that as well. And then the second part was, how does that affect my opinion of her? I think it doesn't. I'm trying to think here. I guess maybe it might increase my opinion of her. I don't think I would like Katniss if she were like, I am the best thing since sliced bread, you know, and I'm gonna win this war single-handedly. She recognizes everything that she's done. I think she had good motivations and was trying to help, but she also recognized or she understood that in helping, she was hurting. And she sees that, I think, immediately, especially on the victory tour when, you know, she just was trying to do this kind thing for Rue, which was also a bit of a middle finger to the Capitol. And now that district, you know, is trying like taking that as something bigger than she meant it to be. And they're fighting back and people are getting killed for her. So I think she does not want to be that symbol and does not want to be considered a hero.
No, I agree. And they want to keep her alive though, because it wouldn't work if she was a martyr, because her being resilient enough to survive the games and resurface and being alive shows resilience that the districts need, because the fight's going to be very, very hard because the Capitol has way more resources and bigger weapons. But I guess my question is, why does a revolution need like this need a person to follow, to look up, to look at,
To galvanize the
yeah, to
people.
galvanize, like, like why not just stand up for your ideals? Why do we have to have a Katniss Everdeen to kind of get everybody together?
Same reason why we have a Donald Trump to get everybody together. Yeah, it's I mean that's obviously the negative thing, but the the point remains. It just takes somebody. It takes somebody saying these things to mm-hmm. wake up and be like, oh, wow, I actually believe those things too. I think it's very much like a, what is that? The pedestrian symptom. What is that called? Bystander. It's the bystander thing. Bystander syndrome. Right, where you think, well, someone else is going to do whatever. And I think if we extrapolate it, because I think it's not like a perfect fit, but mm-hmm. I think you're relying on like, well, someone else is going to fix this. But it takes that one person who is loud and boisterous to like pave the way and then make it so that other people can follow them for good or for ill.
You know, I agree. I think the idea that what gets lost sometimes in the more academic circles of political punditry and arguing in political politics, or even social media, where we're talking about, people do talk about ideals all the time, right? And like, and social media content conversations about politics, even when you're on the same side, sometimes are really frustrating. But one of the more important things is that, I guess the phrase used to be called, or is called, hearts and minds. Like, the idea of the emotion behind the revolution is just as important as the ideals behind the revolution, because people don't always act rationally and logically all the time. Emotions are part of it, which, you know, sometimes the emotion is hate, right? Which we see in our society. And we see it like in 1984, you have the 2 minutes hate and those sorts of things. So it's a very powerful thing. So they know to keep her going because of the emotion that's behind her. I really do think the book makes her a better protagonist, and I agree with you that if she were like going to be just the leader of it, like all of a sudden she's the leader of everybody and there's no flaw to her, there's no inner conflict, there's just the outer conflict, the novel would be very, very just kind of superficial and boring and really would not have stood the test of time that it has, because this book's like almost 20 years old. But like, one of her flaws actually comes out pretty early, because, you know, Snow shows up and she kind of sort of makes this deal with the devil. She's not on the side of the Capitol. She's obviously, her motivation is obviously like, you know, hoping that the friends and family around her stay alive. What lesson do you think she learns about this? What ramifications might it have later? Does this add to her complexity as a character?
I don't know that it necessarily adds anything, just because I think, well, this would be happening to any other character in the same position. And I assume you mean that when President Snow is saying, you need to convince me.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't see any addition to her, so I'll be interested if you disagree with me. And what does it, my gosh. I mean, it's psychological warfare. Guy, it's just, you thought you had an idea of who President Snow is, and then it gets worse. So I think things just escalate, and he knows where he can push on, you know, how to make bruises and push on those bruises, or put mm-hmm. salt in the wound. And because she is, to a certain extent, self-sacrificing, and does care about other people, even though she might try not to outwardly show that she is deeply affected by other people being hurt because of her. So he definitely has her. And you just cut it with those sorts of people, because I think at this point we could probably call him a sociopath.
Yeah.
You unfortunately just have to go along with it, because I don't even know if in the back of her mind she was thinking about, when this all began, she was thinking about a way out. I think she was just trying. She was in survival mode at this point, and like, I just need to step it up and make sure that everything's okay, because she's just trying to keep people alive at this point.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It becomes more complex later on, because she realizes, like, it confirms that she can't trust Snow. Mm-hmm. You know, she always knew she couldn't trust him, but this is just like, okay, she understands who she has to look out for and things like that. And like you said a little earlier, this does put more emphasis on his character and his cruelty, because he was, you know, he was there in the first one, but just kind of like a big brother looming over everybody type. And here we see more of the person, And we see the real viciousness behind all of it. And, you know, it'll obviously, we'll see it some more in the next book, but you see how close he needs to be or feels that he needs to be to all this to pull the strings to get what he wants. Is this a tyrant losing his grip on his power? Is this what happens when that scenario becomes really bad? They get too involved or what's your, what was your take on what Snow was going through during this novel?
That's a good question. I'm also thinking about Roman history and whether do we see this sort of thing? Yeah, holding tighter. Yeah, I think he is squeezing his fist as tightly as he can because I think he is starting to see things unraveling. Mm-hmm. I think he was seeing this in the previous games where people were rooting for Katniss.
Yeah.
And he saw her be this unexpected catalyst potentially for change. And it was filtering through the Capitol, which was pretty dangerous for him, as well as again these things that she was doing that may not have been explicitly directed at the Capitol, but were nonetheless, you know, affecting President Stone, everything, like Rue, like the berries, trying to flaunt the rules and things like that. So I think, yeah, when you feel like your control is slipping through your fingers, you're going to try to grip that rope as much as you are able to. And so I think he sees her as an opportunity as well, because if he has control over the Mockingjay, then he could also have this maybe, revitalization also of his own popularity, you know, because if they had this sort of partnership outwardly, then people might still be, you know, sort of drunk with the bread and the circuses and think everything is okay.
Yeah. And the funny thing is you mentioned Roman, obviously, my classics teacher.
Yes. Yeah.
What I think a lot about it, and, you know, there's parallels to aspects of Rome with this is this really does read like The Empire Strikes Back.
Ooh.
In some ways, like, because my next question is like about Snow and District 12, and he seems to have a fixation on it, especially if you take in the context of the two prequel novels and things. Like the idea that, you know, Vader's after Luke and is like to the point where it's almost obsessive, and he's killing his commanders left and right when they keep screwing up, which, I mean, I would too. The ending is very Empire Strikes Back because, like, one of the heroes ends up in the hands of, you know, Han Solo ends up in the hands of Boba Fett, right? You know, but Peeta ends up in the hands of the Capitol.
Yeah.
They kind of, you know, Lando and Chewie rescue Luke from hanging down left, like, the weather vane at the bottom of Cloud City, which is kind of what, you know, Heavensby and Haymitch and all them do with Katniss and whoever else they can rescue from, you know, from the arena and take to District 13. So there's a lot of parallels to that where this is kind of like that sequel that it's going to, we know they're going to be back in the next novel and stuff like that. But I do see that sort of Snow taking on the Vader and kind of Palpatine role in a sense. And of course, there's that line in Star Wars itself where Leia tells Tarkin, the more you tighten your grip, the more stars slip through your fingers. So you're right. He's, you know, tyrants get desperate. They start to hold on to things or focus on things that are just, and they get more and more irrational. Snow weirdly plays it cool through a lot of it. As angry as he is, he's very, very cold, which is almost scarier. You know, does he have a vendetta against District 12? I mean, has he been, has he always thought or realized that District 12 is one of the most dangerous districts because of their way of life or because of the people in there or something? It seems like because of Haymitch in the other novel and et cetera, and what he does to her, his girlfriend, you know, and then here with like really just targeting it on Katniss in this way, like, is this personal for him?
Oh, you betcha. Yeah, he's got a grudge and yeah, he's not afraid to hold on to it. It really is. I mean, he can say that they're dangerous all he wants, but it's really just because he was scammed. I don't know. He was either scammed or he was just jilted. He's a jilted lover. And so he holds on to that for sure. He holds on to that. It carries through to Haymitch's, and who even knows what other, you know, because they only had one winner, which was Haymitch, and that took a very long time. So, yeah. I mean, how are they any different than, you know, another district? I feel like. I don't know.
It's always interesting to me that the outer districts are that there's a certain amount of freedom that they have in some ways because they're so poor. Like District 12 is so poor. It's also so small that they get away with a lot more than some of the other districts do. Although what's interesting is that Katniss points out that the children's don't yearn for the mines here because District 12 doesn't allow child labor. And the other districts, like some of them know certain skills that come with the area of production for the capital because the kids are put to work earlier. And it's kind of interesting to me. The other thing that's really interesting is when the two people from District 8 show up, right? And they're on the run and they have like no survival skills. Like Katniss has to teach them like basic things because District 8's just not the type of environment. It made me think a lot about the way that the pandemic is structured and how obviously purposefully segregated it is in the division of the labor that it provides for the capital. Like, you know, they obviously have media that kind of separates them, and you don't very see a lot of crossover between the districts, maybe because a lot of them are kept poor. People in District 12 don't necessarily know how to farm the way that people in District 11 do. And none of them know really how to, do they know how to fish or use the water the way that people in District 4 do. Like, it's really, really interesting of how segmented it is and how on purpose that is, because it does not allow for talk between them, but also like development of certain skills. Like there's, all of them have some sort of huge strength, but there's so many deficiencies because they have to focus on that one thing. That seems to be on purpose. What else did you notice, like, in terms of what you were seeing now in these two novels between all these districts and how that plays into the capital's keeping power?
Yeah, well, I think if you can divide people in terms of belief systems as well as abilities, then you think that they probably will be unable to rise up against you potentially. Trying to think, like, I feel like there's probably a connection to enslaved people both in the ancient world, because I'm thinking of Spartacus. I was watching that recently, and enslaved people that we had here in the U.S. and how, you know, you might be worried about there being an uprising, so you kind of separate them that way. But if there's almost a helplessness about that, about people in Pen M, because if they only have this one trade and they're in the place that has that one trade, then they can't really leave anywhere else because they won't make it. And they understand the systems within that area. So in doing that, I think, you are preventing potentially an uprising, because if everyone worked together, all the different districts, or if they realize that they could do such a thing, then that would be so disastrous. But also they seed, I think, messages that are making it seem like one district is faring better than another district. And lies threaded through with truth, because we do know that districts closer to the capital do fare better than other ones, but that's seeding, you know, jealousy and resentment. So again, you have this inability to connect across the way, because you're believing this and like, well, we're never going to get together with District 11 or whatever, because we have some sort of issues. And she doesn't really get into it, but you know, some of the district, like, it is 11, right, that seems primarily to be an area that has more people of color than other districts that we see. I feel like race doesn't necessarily get played too much, but I feel like there's probably something still there just because we know the nature of our country anyways, that it's just like within the soil. So I imagine that is something. But yeah, I mean, they just can't rise up together. And I think it can't be just one district, because one district rising up is, it's going to be destroyed, which we see at the end of this novel. Mm-hmm. It has to be a unified effort. Yeah, I also think, to go back to your previous question, you know, why is 12 so dangerous, or is it dangerous? Is it resentment? I think its proximity to 13 is also concerning. So I think there's just like that history is there too. But I do think that he's just a very petty man.
Yeah. I always find it interesting how small District 12 is. Like, it doesn't even, because it's supposed to be, I mean, granted, geographically it's smaller than the others, but like, it's essentially like we're living, we're adjacent to District 12. Like, it's supposed to be essentially Appalachia, like West Virginia. And the way she talks, it's like everybody in District 12 is in that one place, which is the small community. And I know that the population of North America, or Pan Am, is not a very big population from what I gather. You know, I was trying to look up like what caused Pan Am to rise. And it's just, it's hinted at that there were like ecological disasters, and then like basically World War III happened, and from the ashes of that rose Pan Am. And I'm like, well, it seems like, yeah, they're all kind of kept, they're very kept contained as well. District 11, by the way, because I was looking at the map that like on the Hunger Games wiki, like where's each district and stuff like that, and District 11 is essentially the Deep South. So that makes sense. The other thing that makes sense too is when you hear about them talk about what it's like in District 11, it does sound like they've almost reestablished like the antebellum plantation system.
Yeah, Jim Crow. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I'm sure the peacekeepers are white, and that's just real bad luck.
Yeah, but yeah, and I think your point about keeping people separate from one another is a really, really important one, because they even do it within the districts. Now, I would imagine that the people in maybe 1, 2, 3, and 4 who go into the victors' villages and live there, let's say that that's the setup in there, are more revered than anything, because that those districts are so used to producing winners, you know? They have career tributes, which means that all these people do is train to be in the Hunger Games in case they get picked. Mm-hmm. It's very, the reference that some people will get and some people won't, it's very Soviet Olympics athletes. Like the Soviet national hockey team back in, like, if you look at the history, like the Miracle on Ice in 1980, they were all technically members of the Russian army, but they never served a day in their lives in the Soviet army. They were just kind of commissioned and then put to train in hockey, you know, as opposed to like, actually, so this is kind of like the way for the government to kind of like, you know, keep their amateur status going, because they were almost like money laundering payment to these people to play hockey. Whereas like, you know, US system was like college kids and stuff like that. So the career tributes kind of strike me as that they're essentially put into this almost Soviet style athletic program to produce the best athletes or the best tributes for the Hunger Games. So they might be like celebrities when they come back and win, because there's so many of them. But you notice how like there's literally 3 people in District 12 who ever won the Hunger Games, which are Haymitch, Peeta, and Katniss, and they go to live in Victor Village, which, if you think about it, like, you come from like abject poverty and you're given a nice house, you're going to take the nice house, right? And they're comfortable, but you could see the resentment build up in the rest of the people around them, in a sense. She does mention that it's kind of not the same, and she's still the same person, but she can tell that, especially when bad things start to happen to people in District 12, the people are like giving her the side eye, like blaming her for it. And I think that's, in a way, just the putting in the outer districts that don't produce a lot of winners on a regular basis, it serves the capital's purpose, because it segregates those people. And, you know, they can align themselves against the scapegoat when things are not good, and they can blame the winner of the games, because the winner of the games like brought this upon them or something like that, especially with Katniss, the situation. Or am I completely off base here?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I think she is now. Oh, I think she is now other, compared to, you know, where she was. Well, that family was kind of othered anyways, to be honest. So I think she was always on the outskirts.
Kind of exacerbates the situation.
Yeah, now I think it's just worse. And, you know, you've been there and now you come back and it's almost as if you are a... I don't think it's as extreme as when soldiers came back for Vietnam, though that is kind of what I was thinking of, you know, people felt like there was something bad about them. And so they treated them poorly because they saw a lot of stuff and they had to do some things as well. And so it kind of feels in a way like that. But she's used to it. I mean, you know, it might be a little bit worse, but I think, like I said, I think they were always alienated from that society anyways.
I find it's what's interesting to me is that, like, you know, this book was published almost 20 years ago and it still holds up really well in terms of its political commentary and societal criticisms. And like the way our modern society is just a reflection of or another gilded age. You know, if you think about like the wealth being concentrated in a very select group of people, you know, the capital, the way the people in capital are like obsessed with plastic surgery and their fashions, and like, because we've seen the effects of the too many fillers, too many facelifts and stuff like that, that certain face that some people have these days because they've just gone too much into buying into a certain look and such, and they've done all the plastic surgery, the morphlings, right? I mentioned opioids, I mentioned meth, you know, and that's a real problem in our society, created by a drug company, of course, pitting a societal groups of each other, the manipulation of the media, because like Katniss knows nobody's ever going to see the footage of District 8 and District 12 because of they don't want that to happen. The excesses of the Capitol, they literally have like Epicac to take when they're eating big meals to go vomit and come back and keep eating, which is like gluttonous beyond anything when people in the other districts are starving. And the other thing I have, because I made this list, the other thing I found interesting was how they have all these technological advances yet crumbling infrastructure. Did you notice that too?
Crumbling infrastructure where?
Like buildings, bridges, roads, and things like that. Like the district has weaponry, it's got hovercrafts, it's got this ability to create these games, these scientific advances, and yet it seems that all around Panem, the conditions of buildings and houses and things and a lot of the just infrastructure of the country is not in particularly good shape, except for maybe the capital.
Yeah, it reminds me of, so we're in a, well, for Latin one, we're in a Britannia unit, and where it's a flashback, so we get to see two people who are from Britain, and then they immigrate into Rome, and we talk about Roman imperialism and Britain and everything, and once they left Britain, the infrastructure sort of started to break down, which is really interesting. That Rome? Was it the Roman soldiers? Why did they leave and then this stuff was happening? So I'm just sort of reminded about that as you are speaking. Well, all of the funds are going into the center, and I think because that is where the power is directed, then that's where the most care and upkeep is going to be. And I think this is, again, another punishment to be petty, that, you know, you decided to rebel and there will be no forgiveness. And I will also, well, we won't forget. And so you're just going to have to live with what we give you, which is not going to be very much.
The other thing that really struck me too, and maybe it's because of things that I've seen in the news lately, is the way that the Capitol is like fixated on shaving body hair. Do you notice that? Like, because like at one point Katniss is like, they're going to shave all my body hair off. And I'm wondering, like, it just struck me as very odd. Like, what's the big deal. You know, the only time I can think of, oh, it's necessary to shave your hair is like the military or in places where there's like a lot of lice or something, right? So they do that. But like it struck me as very weird and kind of sketchy. But it does track with this very toxic aspect of our culture, especially among a lot of men, of infatuation with teenage girls or barely legal. It made me wonder about that. Is my mind not working correctly, or did you kind of pick up on that, the idea that the powerful, like, almost like want to, no pun intended, groom somebody like a Katniss or something because of their whatever desires they have?
Yeah, I've not ever taken it that way, so it's an interesting look at it. I don't disagree with you. I think a lot of this is potentially a social commentary on how fads and things change. You know, way back, obviously this is really taking from Roman culture as well. You know, you mentioned the epicac, and that was, you know, something that they would be drinking olive oil in order to throw up, more so the rich, because, you know, the they wanted to taste everything at the dinner, right? So so that is just something. And yeah, having this lack of the Aristotelian golden mean as they're doing things. But, you know, back then they would wear chalk or lead, you know, as whitening on their face, or, you know, have wigs and things like that. So all that to say that things shift. And I think, I don't know, 2009, I wonder where we were. I think we go back and forth. I am more focused, I think, on the female side of it, because I feel like everyone was probably doing it in Pan Am. I feel like it seems like it would be an all gender thing, though I don't really recall, because we're in Katniss's POV, whether we see this kind of stuff happening with PETA, if he's getting shaved, etc. But, like, you know, if you think about bikini waxes and all of that, I think we had been in a time of like, yeah, body hair, the less is more. And now I think we're coming back. Like women, there's more of an outcry of like, bring back the bush. So there really is. So I think it just goes through these waves, but you are correct that, you know, when there's no hair there, there's no bush, it looks prepubescent. And so, which is a little startling, you know, and if you're wondering if someone's like, yeah, I'm attracted to that. And you're like, well, I've got some questions for you. So the grooming is not necessarily something, that I think is far off. Okay. I think that could be something. But then, yeah, what is that commentary of like, we've got these children, we want them to be children. That makes it even worse of like, they really know what they're doing. We know that it's children killing children.
Yeah.
But now it's like, we really want that imagery to be children killing children. And then also you think about little Rue, who I can't remember her age.
Like a preteen, like a tween, right? And 11, 12, 13. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to think that she was being bodily groomed in that way is pretty startling too.
Yeah, it is. Because I think of like 2009. So this is right around the time that like Britney and Lindsay were having like public breakdowns. And things, but you still have this very, I mean, we still have a very toxic masculine culture in this country, but we were still in that era of that very toxic male, boy, guy culture, where you had things like Maxim magazine was popular during the 2000s, and sort of this kind of softcore type of pornography, or like almost pornography, that was like acceptable, quote unquote, because it wasn't like Playboy or it wasn't straight up porn. So it was like a lot of bikini things, and those magazines were full of like, you know, guys stuff about getting women, and it really was this sort of entitlement that they were pushing. And this infatuation that existed, especially in the 2000s, with very young actresses who were like just of age. I remember there was like this running thread of just like weird anticipation among some men when the Olsen twins were going to hit 18. And you look, step it back and look at it and you're like, that's disgusting. You know, and I mean, now I know what we know about some people in upper parts of the office and society, because what we've seen come out of like things like the Epstein files is like, oh,
and Drake.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, and Drake. Yes. You know, but you're right. I mean, we've seen this happen, but like even then, like pornography, for instance, does still have the shaved pubic area and things like that on both men and women, I mean, women and men and things. So it struck me. Not in a perverted way, but it kind of pointed to that very creepy underlying thing about our society and youth, especially the way that we tend to sexualize it. But you're also right. It also kind of ties into things like the amount of plastic surgery that the people in the Capitol, I mean, the people, like, they almost like disfigure themselves in the Capitol to get the latest thing. Like Effie Trinket's like one of the best examples of it, right?
Yeah. I don't think that's far off from our current society.
No, watch enough television and you see like what people are looking like. You can't recognize some.
Yeah. Some and that people. Was the whole thing. Well, not the whole thing, but one of the themes of the Demi Moore film.
The Substance?
Substance. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So, two kind of big questions and then we'll start wrapping up. Three, really. First, this is easy. How long did it take you to figure out that there was a widespread conspiracy to keep Katniss alive, and it was connected to the revolution? And does that hold up upon multiple readings because you know the twists?
I think it does hold up because it's still, I think, really well done, and it's mm-hmm. obviously in Katniss's perspective. So you're sort of along for the ride and seeing things, but it now you can appreciate it more because you can look at these sorts of hints and see, like, oh yes, aha. I think obviously you're asking me a question of when I read it in 2012.
Yeah,
but I'm pretty sure that I was surprised at what had happened because I thought maybe they were all in it, you know, like they were protecting PETA and it looked, oh, this is good. And then, oh, actually we're protecting PETA because we need to keep him alive because we need you on our side, sort of thing. So I think it was all very shocking. And it's also, you know, you have some of these characters like the one who's like super sarcastic and really angry.
Oh, Joanna.
Yeah, Joanna. You have her and then you have Finnick and you're like, I don't really trust these people at all. But there are little things like Finnick, him and his care for Mags, you're thinking, oh, mm-hmm. okay, well, maybe. And then BT and
Wyrus.
Yes, thank you. Are they're like lovable nerds. So it's just like Joanna. You're just, you know, she's a live wire to a certain, you necessarily can't, that's not the right term, but you like cannot necessarily trust her. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, oh my gosh, what is she doing? She's cutting out the arm. So I think definitely I was very shocked when I first read this. And I think it still holds up. Now, of course, I'm expecting all that to happen, but it's still fun and you still feel that suspense, I think.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. In fact, watching that conspiracy develop and then get revealed at the end is still really, really interesting to me. The other thing I wanted to ask about was Katniss's obvious post-traumatic stress syndrome that's developing probably more than PETA's, if you know, because, and Haymitch is obviously just, he crawled into the bottle. And this one scene where she and Haymitch get drunk together, I think that's where I was the most worried for her in the novel, because I was like, I saw them getting drunk together. I think they were barking at PETA at one point or whatever. And I'm like, this is your future if you don't watch out. You know, like, I can see how Haymitch, like, fell into the bottle after, you know, what had happened in his games. And, like, mm-hmm. Katniss is under so much pressure and she's having so many nightmares. It's like, it's easy to just start the drinking. And I was legitimately getting worried for her that, like, if you don't do something, if you don't stop yourself early, you're going to end up like Haymitch Abernathy. What other things are you seeing, like what Collins is showing us about like approach, because this is like coming back from a war, right? So like PTSD and things like that in the novel.
The sleeplessness. I feel like her relationship with her mom and sister have sort of shifted. The Gail relationship, I think, has also changed. But part of that, I think, also is, Katniss had to inevitably change because of this. So obviously, trauma is involved, but I think sometimes someone comes back from something and you're trying to figure out how do you move around that person? How do you be, how are you existing around that person? So it's hard for me to say. It is interesting with the that we see this and knowing what happens with Mockingjay. I would feel like that would be way worse, losing her sister. But yeah, I mean, oof, very, very hard. Yeah, I guess those are kind of the points that I see. How about you?
What's interesting to me too is like Prim's there, but she's not. She shows up a few times in the book, but like she's mentioned, I think, more than we actually see her, which was interesting to me. So we never really get to know Prim as a character beyond like a few scenes here and there. The nightmares are definitely something. And I think the added pressure of her having to put on the public face that everything is fine is compounding the trauma. Because she's not getting help for it, or she cannot live a quiet life after this. So she has to be on and put on the show, and then inside she's falling apart. And I think Collins is doing a good job of showing that in the way that, yeah, like a veteran from a war and things like that. The last question I have before the big one has to do with Sunrise on the Reaping. So Sunrise on the Reaping, as you guys, if you listen to that episode, which I think we recorded, or like we said, we recorded last year around this time, actually, is the story of Haymitch's games, the 50th Hunger Games. How does, now that you've read Catching Fire, after reading Sunrise on the Reaping, and they're almost like companion novels to one another, how does knowing the full backstory of Haymitch, because we get it a little bit, and I didn't really go into it here because we get it in Sunrise on the Reaping, but we get a pretty good summation of Haymitch's games. We don't get the whole thing with the girl and everything, but we get like, the girl he loved, and I can't remember her name, the one who dies at the end with the poison candy. I want to say her name was Lucy, but I don't think that's right. But here you get like this whole thing. So does Sunrise and what is the effect does knowing everything from Sunrise and everything have on your rereading of Catching Fire? Did it, or did it have no effect at all?
No, I think, yeah, I think they are great companion stories because not only the arena, well, yeah, I'll start with the arena. The arena, which we didn't really talk about, but I
Oh,
really
yeah.
like the design of the arena in Catching Fire. I thought that that was very, I liked how unique it was and the clock and Wyrus, etc., figuring out what it was. But the arenas are similar in that, certain things are happening, the everything's dangerous, and then the electricity playing a role. You have the characters that are, because this is really when we see BT, we now know how Wyrus got to be the way she is, because of the torture that she went through. And then with Haymitch, yeah, you just think that he's drunk and, for good reason. But then you realize, oh wow, there's actually, it wasn't just the arena, it was that his life was got even worse when he came home. His family was killed, his loved one ate a poisoned candy. He decided to punch his friends so that they stayed away from him. So yeah, it gives answers to questions that we may have or may not have known that we had. And I think they pair well together, as I say. Yeah, it gives, well, maybe it doesn't. Let me think about this. The epilogue gives hope. I think if you were to just read this and the other one, you would think, ooh, Katniss is not going to have a good future. So I'll take back my gives hope, because at the end of it, beyond with the accepting the epilogue, you think that Haymitch's life is going to be pretty bad. And so at the end of this, you're thinking, wow, Katniss's life is going to be pretty bad.
it makes Haymitch, I think, a more tragic character too, now that you know the whole story. Because prior to this, he was kind of acerbic and drunk all the time. And it's not like you didn't like him, but there was almost a clownishness to him too. You didn't expect him to be so like with it when he was getting them into the games and then with the revolution. Like it is kind of surprising if all you perceive Haymitch as is this drunk who is cannot face his problems because what has happened to him. But knowing what actually happened, it does gives you some compassion for him because it's just like, wow, he was destroyed emotionally and never recovered. And so yeah, there's a lot of really interesting stuff out of there. And I do like that these are companions to one another. I'm curious to what she would do if she writes a third novel in this prequel, if there's any need for a third prequel, or she'll write like a sequel somewhere down the line or something. What other story could she tell?
Well, we'll get, Effie Trinket. I would like to see, was this hypothetical? Was this rhetorical? I'm answering anyways.
No, go ahead.
I would like to see Finnick and Annie's
Yeah.
year, and having that POV and seeing their love story, which I think would maybe would be the happiest it could, because at least it temporarily had a happily ever after, though she was negatively impacted mentally
Yes.
and emotionally. So that would be interesting. And Joanna, I don't think was the same year as Finnick, even though she knew Finnick. No, she couldn't have been, because she would have been killed.
Yeah.
So yeah, any of those, I think those people from the years that we've had them. The first, if she went way, way back, or even during the war, but maybe it's better not knowing. Maybe it's better just like wondering what happened.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, because part of me is like has always been curious as to like when did human civilization collapse the way it did prior to the creation of Panem, and how did it go? But what story do you tell there, right? All right, so is this required reading?
Required reading. So obviously, I recommend that you read all of the Hunger Games, but I think if I were to, I think the Hunger Games, the first one, is still the one that I would say, like, yes, that is required reading. And anything else is a plus, but I think you get everything you need from there, both the nods to the past as well as the commentary on the present and the future. So recommended, yes, but maybe not required for me.
Yeah, I guess you're right. The other thing I think this really does is add another layer to the story for obvious reasons. But like you notice that like when you're looking at historical figures and they're known for like maybe a particular moment or a particular period, and yet they lived a lot longer than that, or you learn about their personal lives and things get messier and messier and messier, right? Because they're human. And as time goes on, they do more things, and our culture wants to keep everybody in their snapshot box of that one moment. And I think we're getting the messy with Katniss throughout this novel. And I think that's a good, really good reason to read this too, is that because it shows you like how nuanced the people in these movements are and how you cannot think that the quote symbol of this is not. Like you can't dehumanize them. You have to realize that what their humanity does for them and to them, even though, yeah, she has become a symbol. So I think that internal struggle is really on point here. And I'm kind of and like I said, I'm curious to when we eventually get to Mockingjay, how we'll look at that. So all right, we did not have any feedback on the last couple of episodes. Whatever we read about episode 110, we had already read it last episode. So I've got one more thing to ask you, which is what's next?
Okay, Tom, I'm very sorry in advance, because the spring comes, and spring rain, spring brings flowers. And we've talked about, we've mentioned this in passing, and I'm one of those people that I feel like I shouldn't talk about something unless I've experienced it. You know, it happened with Midsommar. I would make references, but I had not seen Midsommar. And so I thought I need to see it before I keep making references. And we've referred to this book a couple times. And so I think it's time that we, you know, get our reputations back up again. So we're going to read. I'm so sorry. We're going to read Flowers in the Attic by V.C. Andrews.
Oh, my God. Oh, jeez.
We have to. We can't keep referencing it without having read it.
My grandmother will be so proud of me right now.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, come back for that?
Maybe. Unless people skip it. Well, we should check. Do you get to see the numbers of downloads?
I'll have to check.
It'd be interesting to compare it. People just skip that wholesale.
Oh, jeez. All right. Well, until then, thank you very much for listening, dear God, and take care.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, have a friend that you trust. Dig out any tracking devices that you may have in your arm.
That's right. Good night.
Good night. Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Required Reading with Tom and Stella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.